Indian raids were always to be expected. Nevertheless, each seemed to burst upon the West Texas settlements as a total surprise. Sergeant Nettles had put the company on police detail. The name had promised an interesting task, but Gideon soon learned it meant raking manure from the corrals or picking up miscellaneous litter from the post grounds. Wearing their gray fatigues, he and Jimbo were cleaning the parade near the adjutant's office when a civilian loped past them, leaving Gideon blinking away the sting of dust. Without taking time to tie his horse, the man pushed through the office door. Gideon and Jimbo stared at each other in silent curiosity. The horse trembled in exhaustion, its shining hide dripping sweat. Jimbo's resistance to temptation had always been marginal.
You better go tie that horse for the man.
He's too tired to run off.
You never can tell about a horse.
Jimbo walked purposefully. Gideon followed, looking back over his shoulder for a sign of the sergeant. Nettles was contrarily single-minded about seeing that any job he assigned was properly finished. Standing with Jimbo near an open window, Gideon heard the name Ben Ficklin and Comanche. Ben Ficklin was a stage stand in a small village near the confluence of the South and Middle Conchos, a few miles south and west of the fort. It was named for a frontiersman and former Union officer who owned the San Antonio-El Paso mail line. The little settlement was made up mostly of stage line employees and farmers who raised feed for the company and the military. It was as staid and respectable as St. Angela was wicked and wild. It offered little to hold the average soldier's interest. The civilian hurried out of the adjutant's office.
We tied your horse for you, sir.
The man gave him no acknowledgement but trotted briskly toward the residence of the commanding officer. In a couple of minutes, he came back with Colonel Thomas, both men taking long strides. Jimbo had spilled several bits of paper out of his sack, and the wind had fortuitously carried them against the building near the open window. Gideon straightened and saluted as the commanding officer approached. Thomas halted.
Trooper, do you know where to find Lieutenant Hollander?
Gideon still held the salute, for the colonel had not returned it.
I seen him at the corrals.
Go fetch him for me. Tell him it's urgent. If you see Sergeant Nettles, send him too.
Yes, sir.
Gideon set out in a trot, looking back in envy at Jimbo, who bent by the window, innocently picking up the loose paper he had dropped there in the first place. The lieutenant and the sergeant were at the corral. Hollander was trying out a new bay horse and showing unrestrained pleasure. Nettles seemed gratified.
I've been having Jimbo ride him some.
Good man with a horse, that Jimbo.
Wished he was as good with everything else.
Out of breath, Gideon saluted Hollander and leaned against the fence, his chest heaving.
Colonel! Colonel says he wants the lieutenant. Wants you too, Sergeant. Indians!
Take you long enough to say so.
Don't unsaddle him, Charger. I may be needing him.
Nettles caught Hollander's reins and tossed them to Gideon. After pausing to tie the horse, Gideon was too short of breath to match the men's brisk pace. He managed a quick glance at Laundry Row, hoping to see Hannah York. He saw only the old woman shoving dry wood into the blaze beneath her steaming pot. Jimbo strode excitedly to meet Gideon.
We're finally fixing to do something besides drill and tote rocks. They've taken us out after Indians.
Gideon had sensed it, but the reality stunned him. This was the duty for which they were supposedly trained. Yet in the long waiting, it had become something remote, not quite real. A cold fear settled on him, and then shame for the fear.
Comanche raiding party. Taking some horses from the Bismarck farm, then swung over by Ben Ficklin town. Knocked some Mexican fella upside the head and run off a bunch of stock that belonged to the stage line.
He pointed north. The Indians had gone in that direction, toward the plains.
Dozen of them, maybe. So the man says.
Gideon's chill persisted. Stories indicated that a dozen Comanches could hammer down the gates of hell. Hollander and Nettles hurried out, the sergeant half a pace behind, as befitted the demands of rank and race.
No bugle, Sergeant. That would just bring the other companies out.
Nettles beckoned first to Jimbo.
You'll find part of the company policing around the hospital. Tell them to assemble.
He turned to Gideon.
You get the ones at the corrals. I don't want to see nobody walking. Last man to fall in line will clean out the company sinks.
After the company formed in front of the barracks, the lieutenant wasted no time in explanations. Enlisted men were not entitled to them.
I have orders to take 20 volunteers. I want a nucleus of seasoned men, but I want some recruits to get field experience, too. Charger, you and Jimbo are going.
He went down the line, picking his other volunteers. He tapped Big Dempsey, who stood half a head taller than anybody else and was hard to overlook. The quiet Sergeant Waters was chosen as a matter of course. In all, Hollander selected 9 recruits and 10 experienced men. Nettles would make the count come to 20. Hollander frowned.
We can't be burdened with extra horses. If any man's horse is disabled, that man has to drop out and fend for himself. I don't think any of you want to do that. Not where those Indians may lead us. So take care of your horses first and last. Depend on God to take care of you.
Hollander left, taking quick strides toward the hospital to gather his necessities. Nettles stood with fists on his hips, his dark eyes crackling with threat.
There's a lot of white people don't think we're soldiers. But you'll be soldiers while we're out there. Any man disgraces his uniform, any man don't live up to his duty, he's gonna wish it was the Comanches had a hold of him instead of me.
Nettles let no man take any step except in a run while they changed into their field blues, gathered what little they were to take with them, and saddled their horses. Hollander and Nettles took the lead. Colonel Thomas stood in front of his house, watching. Hollander saluted. Gideon saw no more emotion in the colonel's face than if the men were being sent off to morning drill. He realized that the colonel had watched hundreds of such processions ride out of Concho and other forts. But this was Gideon's first. He found it difficult to accept the colonel's dispassionate attitude. They were innocents, most of them, riding into a big, strange country to hunt for Indians with the understood purpose of killing them if they could. It was also understood, if not stated, that the Indians could kill them. The colonel's door opened, and Hannah York stepped onto the porch, drying her hands on an apron as she watched the troopers ride by. Gideon's breath went short. This was the first time he had seen her since that night they had met. Her eyes locked on him. Her hand came up as if she were about to wave, but she caught herself and looked around anxiously to see if anybody had observed the move. She quickly clasped both hands in the apron to keep them from trouble. She made Gideon think of a tiny bird, trapped and fearful. He kept looking back at her until he was twisted halfway around in the saddle. They rode west at first, following the river until it bent northward. They left it, heading generally westward with a tilt to the north. Gideon turned once to see the fort receding into the distance. Leaving it, he felt vulnerable, somehow alone. The cold dread he had felt when he first came into this country returned to him now. It settled in his stomach like a leaden weight. Perhaps the other men felt the same fear but managed to hide it. Or perhaps he was the only one who carried this burden, the only coward in the company. At length, the detail came upon the Middle Concho, which flowed from the west. Gideon had heard Hollander tell Nettles that a civilian was to follow the Indians' trail to wherever it crossed this river. There he would wait, putting the troops hours closer to the raiders. In due course, a horseman spurred toward them. He rode a big sorrel with 2 stocking feet and a blaze in its face. Jimbo leaned forward in his saddle, giving the horse his full attention. If he felt any concern about Indians, he hadn't shown it. He looked as happy as if he had good judgment.
That there is a horse, Gid.
The civilian did not salute, though he came close with an upward motion of his hand. His stern military bearing gave Gideon a notion that he had some army experience, probably with the Confederacy. He was a blocky man, not in the least fat. His face was covered by a short brown beard. His eyes showed misgivings as he surveyed the black soldiers.
Frank, I'm glad it's you instead of Captain Newton or one of them other damn Yankee dimwits.
Hollander accepted that as a compliment after its fashion.
I happen also to be a Yankee, Pat Maloney.
In your case, I haven't put the damn in front of it yet.
Gideon felt Maloney's eyes pass over him, but they did not single him out. Maloney appeared to see little merit in any of the men.
Army had some soldiers out here in the beginning. Yankee government may be mighty, but it can't turn black into white.
Gideon looked quickly at Nettles. The sergeant stared off to the north, his jaw set hard, the cheekbones stretching his dark skin.
I volunteered these men myself. They'll do.
The trail was plain enough that Gideon felt he could have followed it himself. But the realization that it had been made only a few hours ago sent a chill to playing along his spine. For a time, the troops followed it in an easy pace. Northwesterly across rock-edged rolling hills, down long, wide valleys, where the thick turf was like a grass carpet. Clusters of brown buffalo looked up from their grazing and scattered in an odd rolling lope. Once Gideon's eyes caught a movement to the west, and his breath stopped. What at first appeared to be feathered Indians became pronghorn antelope racing in single file, cutting in front of the soldiers and passing on. Hollander reached down to his carbine, but changed his mind.
One of those would make us a good supper.
There may not be any supper.
Long miles passed beneath the horses' hooves, leading the troops toward the middle section of the North Concho. The soft, rounded contours of the hills made them appear deceptively gentle, a promise proven empty by closer acquaintance. Rockier ground made tracks harder to see. Maloney slowed.
I better move out in front. Y'all stay behind me a ways. If I have to double back to hunt for lost tracks, I don't want you and them blackbirds covering them up.
Hollander came near smiling.
I'll take care of my blackbirds, Pat. You just worry about the tracks.
He turned in the saddle and searched the ranks.
Charger, come up here. Jimbo, you too.
Hollander seemed to feel he was doing the pair a favor.
I'm giving you both a chance to prove your mettle. Mr. Maloney needs to devote his full attention to the tracks. You'll ride up there with him and watch out for Indians.
Gideon's stomach drew into a knot. Jimbo showed not the slightest concern. Gideon was certain that he did not comprehend the situation. Maloney's eyes narrowed suspiciously.
You boys look to me like a pair of greenies.
They're good boys. You can bet your life on it.
No, you're betting my life on it.
He set the sorrel into an easy trot. Without hesitation, Jimbo moved out beside him. Gideon did hesitate, then had to use his tiny spurs to catch up. When the three were 100 yards ahead, Lieutenant Hollander started moving, keeping the pace set by Maloney. Maloney jerked his thumb first to the left, then to the right.
You boys spread out 20, 30 yards on either side of me. Keep a sharp watch. When he goes to sleep, I'll shoot him. Tell God he just died.
Maloney need not have been concerned. Gideon saw everything that moved, from jackrabbits flicking their long ears to a distant hawk making slow circles, watching for something its size to reveal itself on the prairie. As the long afternoon wore on toward dusk, Maloney said nothing. Whatever his occasional problems in seeing and following the tracks across hard ground, he shared none of his thoughts or feelings except in his troubled face. A while before dark, they came to the river. Tracks indicated that the Indians' horses had watered but had not crossed over. Maloney motioned for Gideon and Jimbo to stand their ground while he swam his horse over and rode a little way up and down to be certain. Presently he came back, evidently satisfied, but not saying so. Gideon felt a tug of resentment. He could tell them something. Their being just soldiers, or being black, did not mean they were uninterested.
What river is this?
Good God.
The North Concho, everybody knows that.
Maloney compromised his silence, but not much.
It's the same damn river that runs by your fort. We'll be coming to the head of it up north and some west of here. Past that, the next living water is the Big Spring.
Gideon knew nothing of the Big Spring. He had not seen a map and could not have read it if he had. A piece of pecan bark bobbed along with the flow of the current. He stared at it, imagining himself taking a small log and floating on it all the way back to the post. It was a foolish notion, and he did not toy with it long. He wasn't even sure he wanted to go back. For all his apprehension, it came to him that this was one of the few days since his arrival that he had not dug a ditch, toted rocks, or drilled in the hot sun until his nose bled. Maloney circled his hand over his head, signaling Hollander to come up. He showed the lieutenant how the tracks were going.
Dark's coming. We won't be able to see him much longer. Chances are 2-1 they'll head for the big spring. Now, if you want to gamble, we can go straight to it and not worry about tracks. Dark won't have to stop us.
Hollander frowned.
2-1? What about the third chance? It's showered up here lately. I've been seeing potholes with water in them. Indians don't have to go to the spring.
Indians never have to do anything. That's why the army hardly ever finds them.
And if we guess wrong, they'll be gone for sure.
Well, might be just as well.
He studied the troopers, his doubts visible.
Half of these men are raw recruits.
We have the Indians outnumbered.
Indians are never outnumbered. One of them's good for 3 or 4 your Yankee-fied blackbirds. Meaning no disrespect, of course.
His expression showed he meant all of it. Hollander's eyes followed the tracks upriver.
We'll stay with the trail as long as we can see it. Seems to me they've been getting fresher. The Indians will have to rest, too.
What army manual did you read that out of, Frank?
He set out following the tracks in the river. He did not waste a glance at either Gideon or Jimbo, but expected them to know their duty and do it. The two troopers rode side by side. It seemed unlikely the Indians would charge from across the river. Jimbo gloried in his work and seemed not in the least tired or worried.
I wish the army could be like this all the time.
When dusk faded into full darkness, Maloney held up and waited for Hollander.
There'll be a sliver of moon directly. I could still find you this spring.
We'll rely on the tracks. Sergeant Nettles, have the men water their horses, then set up a picket line. Cold supper, no fires. We don't want the Indians to know we're here.
Oh, you could climb up on that hill yonder, build a fire big enough to roast a horse for all the difference it's gonna make. Them Indians know where we're at.
The army has its way.
Yeah, I know. And I never figured out how in the hell you Yankees ever beat us.
Because they were deep into country better known to the Indians than to most white people, Hollander had a third of the detail on guard at any one time all night. Gideon thought it was just as well. He lay sleepless in his blanket most of the time anyway. He heard every call of the night community and wondered if they were really birds. Every time a horse stamped his foot on the picket line, he expected a war whoop. He stood his guard tour with hands sweaty cold on his carbine, and he spent the rest of the night lying on his back, listening, wondering if anyone else was getting much sleep. He didn't have to worry about Jimbo. Gideon was not simply worried about what the Indians might do. He wondered what he might do. Could he stand his ground like a soldier, or would he cut and run? He kept remembering that skirmish on the Colorado. He remembered fear. He remembered helplessness. He wondered what he might have done had the frightened brown horse not taken choice out of his hands. He was haunted by a feeling that he might have run. There was no bugle to awaken the men. None was necessary. As soon as Hollander stirred, Sergeant Nettles was up and around, giving brusque orders, nudging sleeping men with the toe of his boot. Gideon had slept a little the last couple of hours when it was almost too late. He found he was under Nettles' hard and demanding stare. The sergeant turned his attention to another man, singularly unwilling to depart from his blankets.
Leatherman! Get up! You're the most trifling piece of nothing I ever had in this company. Get on up there!
Nettles booted the reluctant trooper hard enough that today's ride was likely to be painful. Hollander allowed no fires. Gideon would have enjoyed coffee, but he settled for hardtack and river water. Maloney looked to the rising sun, then to Hollander.
If you can get your boys to wipe the sleep boogers out of their eyes, we'd best be moving. Indians don't take much sleep on the trail. He'll catch up on that when he gets home to where the squaws do the work.
Hollander sought out Gideon and Jimbo with his eyes.
Boys, you know what's expected of you.
Gideon had just assumed someone else were allowed to share the honor, but Jimbo grinned.
Yes, sir.
Jimbo swung atop his horse, and Gideon mounted the brown Judas and rode out with Maloney. His eyes were heavy, his stomach uneasy from missed sleep. Maloney eyed him suspiciously.
You don't look good to me, boy.
Gideon doubted that any black soldier looked good to Maloney, but even in his infirm state, he had the judgment not to say so. Old Colonel would have been proud of his tact. The river narrowed and shallowed and finally disappeared along with the taller grasses. The country had the look of always needing just one more rain. Past the feeder springs, which gave the North Concho birth, the trail led along the rim of a rough hill. The steep and treacherous hillside was strewn with large rocks broken off by time and erosion from the ancient sedimentary layer which formed the ragged crest. Maloney gave the hillside a moment's suspicious study, but continued to circle the rim. Even Gideon's untrained eyes could see that some of the horse tracks led downward. He pointed them out to Maloney. The guide's furrowed brow showed that unsolicited advice was unwanted advice.
Few of their loose horses was all. Main bunch went along the rim to find an easier way down. That's what we'll do.
Presently, Gideon saw that most of the horses, and presumably the Indians, had indeed found a longer, though gentler, descent. The trail was steep, but mostly clear of bad rocks. Gideon let Maloney take the lead, then followed at what he thought was a safe distance. Halfway down, Gideon's brown horse lost footing and sent a shower of small stones rolling past Maloney.
Boy, you got the whole wide world to ride in. Don't be riding on my horse's hind feet.
Gideon did not see the humor. He gave the white man more room and half hoped an Indian was waiting down there. Maloney's luck held. He reached the bottom without incident. In the clear, he waited for Gideon and Jimbo to reach him. The horse trail was plain at the foot of the hill. Maloney rode out a short distance and stopped, turning to watch the troopers make their slow descent, single file, the way he and Gideon and Jimbo had come. Hollander was first. Sergeant Nettles stayed behind to see the others down. Though the breeze swept away the sound, Gideon could see by the sergeant's gestures that he was shouting orders to the men picking their way down. Two troopers were holding back. Just as Nettles turned to get them started, they came on their own straight down the hillside the way a few of the Indians' loose horses had done. Jimbo pointed.
Ain't that Leatherman?
Gideon had to squint.
Yeah, and Ripley, taking a shortcut.
Damn fools, liable to break a horse's leg that way.
At the top, Nettles waved his arm and shouted words, picked up and carried away by the wind. It was useless. Once the two men had started, there was no stopping or backing up. Their speed increased. Two-thirds of the way down, Leatherman's horse fell heavily on its right shoulder, rolling over, kicking wildly. Leatherman threw himself out of the saddle in time to keep the horse from rolling on top of him. He slid, ran, and slid again, carried forward by the momentum. The soldier finally stumbled on a small boulder and finished the last few feet sliding on his belly and hands. The other man's horse lost footing once but managed to catch itself. At the bottom, Leatherman pushed shakily to his feet and dusted himself.
Your horse, man! See to your horse!
When the horse struggled to its feet at the bottom of the hill, it was obvious it would do no more running for a while. It picked up one forefoot and hobbled about on the other three, trembling from pain and fright. The saddle turned on its side. Leatherman's companion Ripley reached the bottom, still in the saddle. His horse limped, though less badly. Jimbo reached Leatherman's horse ahead of anybody else and jumped down, grabbing the reins, talking to the frightened animal. He rubbed his hand along the horse's neck and down its shoulder. He felt carefully of the hurt leg. When he stood up, his eyes were ablaze.
You damn idiot! You are a pure D fool!
In their years of growing up and working together, Gideon had heard Jimbo curse only a few times. It had always been over someone's abuse of a horse or a mule. Jimbo gave Leatherman one of the roundest cursings Gideon had ever heard. Lieutenant Hollander rode up, primed to the same task, but bowed to a superior talent and kept his silence. When Jimbo ran out of steam, Leatherman stood with head down, well chastened. Jimbo turned to Ripley. He had used up the words, but his angry eyes made the message plain.
What about Leatherman's mount? Is its leg broken?
Not broken, sir, but he sprained it pretty bad.
Take a look at Ripley's.
Yes, sir.
Jimbo felt that horse's leg.
He ain't fit to ride either, sir.
Hollander fixed the two men with a punishing stare they couldn't meet.
You remember what I said before we left? See after your horse before yourself or you'll walk. Well, now you'll walk. You're of no use to us afoot, either of you, and we can't afford to break down two more horses by having you ride double with someone else. You'll have to walk back to the post and lead your horses.
Just the two of us?
You brought it on yourselves.
Leatherman's fear was contagious. Ripley looked as if he'd been kicked in the stomach.
There's liable to be Indians out there.
You should have thought of that. Backtrack to the river, then follow it back to Fort Concho. And stay off those horses. If I find out that either of you has ridden a step, I'll hang you up by your thumbs.
The two men were shattered.
Lieutenant, I couldn't.
We're losing time.
Hollander looked at Maloney.
If I was you, Frank, I'd just shoot the both of them.
It would be a waste of horse flesh.
I wasn't talking about the horses. It'd be a fine object lesson to the rest of the men.
Hollander stared at him.
Were you ever an overseer of slaves?
No, I was always a poor man. Always had to do for myself.
Pity. You have all the natural talents.
Maloney gave him a flat, dry grin. Gideon sensed that between the two men stood a contradiction in attitudes. On one hand, an old animosity going back to the war and to the vastly different social and cultural codes of their upbringing. Yet on another level, he discerned a mutual respect, a recognition by each man that the other was capable. The lieutenant might have been finished with Leatherman and Ripley, but Nettles was not. He gave them a blistering look that withered them like corn stalks before a flame.
When we get back.
He let them finish it in their imaginations, where fancy was more terrible than fact. Maloney took his forward position, following the tracks. Gideon and Jimbo moved out to flank him. Gideon looked back once. He watched the two troopers leading their limping horses. In the distance, they looked terribly alone. Two tiny figures almost lost in a sun-bright expanse of hill and rock and short grass prairie. Maloney began running into trouble. He would lose the tracks on long stretches of hard and gravelly ground. When he found them again, where they moved off into softer ground that yielded better to the cutting hooves, they would be fewer than before. Ultimately, he came to a point where the main body of horses had disappeared. He found himself following what he was certain was just three horses and riders. Motioning for Hollander to come up, he pointed to the ground.
They split up. Them Indians have fooled us.
Hollander's mouth hardened.
Not us. You. You're the one to whom the army pays an exorbitant fee for tracking service.
Oh, exorbitant hell!
Maloney lost an hour trying to determine where the main bunch of stolen horses had left the hard ground. He finally settled for following the three horses. He nodded to Hollander.
Most times they split up to confuse you, but they get back together farther on.
Before he'd gone far, the track swung west, then suddenly south again. Maloney's eyes were grim as he again signaled for Hollander.
They doubled back.
Hollander did not seem surprised. Nothing the Indians ever did surprised him much.
To what purpose?
Sometimes Indians like to circle around behind folks that's following them, hit them from the rear.
Three Indians wouldn't hit this many soldiers.
They might if we was straggled out. Scalp or two, a horse. They don't ask for much.
A thought chilled Gideon to the bone.
Leatherman and Ripley.
Maloney and Hollander stared at each other. Maloney nodded.
Lord Almighty.
Hollander turned his horse around. He set out in a long trot, not waiting for the other men. Maloney spurred up to take his place in front, though now it was only a matter of form. They would follow their own back trail, not Indians. In a little while, they were back at the foot of the hill. Like the earlier descent, ascending could safely be done only in single file. Gideon looked around to see who would go up first, and while he waited, Jimbo started. Gideon set in behind him, protectively. Maloney gave them a little time, then he began. Scrambling to keep its footing, Jimbo's horse sent a cascade of small stones and gravel rolling back. Gideon slowed to allow him more of a lead. The horses plodded and labored. In a while, they were at the top. Glancing back, Gideon saw Maloney lagging. Jimbo kept going.
Hold up, Jimbo. Let's wait for the others.
What for? Ain't no Indians here.
That was by no means Jimbo's first error, but it stood strong odds of being his last. Gideon heard the strike of hooves. From behind a clump of thick green junipers 70 yards away, three Indians charged on horses streaked with paint. Gideon's heart went wild. He stared in stunned fascination at a spectacle of running horses, of bright colors, of feather-trimmed shields. One Indian began loosing arrows at an amazing speed. The other two carried rifles. Soon they had cleared half the distance. The other two picked it up. Gideon was too startled to find his voice. He tried to tell Jimbo to whip his horse around and run. Before he could get it said, Jimbo was doing just that. Maloney reached the hilltop and sat on the edge, rifle in his hand. It was 40 yards back to him and less distance to the rapidly closing Indians. Gideon jerked Judas around and jabbed spurs into him. This time the horse didn't carry him headlong into the shouting Comanches. One of the warriors fired his rifle. The shot went astray. An arrow buried into the breast of Jimbo's horse, halfway to the feathers. The animal fell. Carbine in his hand but never fired, Jimbo rolled.
Jimbo!
Gideon's momentum carried him past Jimbo. For a moment, he seemed benumbed, not knowing what to do. With his eye, he measured the distance to the Indians and the impossible distance to Maloney and Hollander, just coming up onto the rim. Maloney had begun firing, but he had not moved toward the stranded pair of soldiers. Gideon was not conscious of any thoughts. He spurred back automatically to the downed Jimbo. Jimbo was on one knee, aiming, firing. Gideon kicked his foot out of the stirrup so Jimbo could swing up behind him. He tried to shout, but his throat seemed blocked. Jimbo stayed on one knee, levering a new cartridge into the chamber. Gideon's breath was short, his face hot. They had to make their stand right here. No one was coming to help them. No one could. The first Indian was near enough that Gideon could see his painted face, the leather shield with jagged lightning streak and red animal tracks. Later, when he had time, he would reflect that he had seen a shield like it on the Colorado. His bullet struck something. He saw a puff of dust. An eagle feather floated away, cut to ribbons. The slug had ricocheted from the heavy shield. Even so, the impact made the Indian loose his arrow too soon. His rush carried him past Gideon and Jimbo. The other two were still coming. One jerked as a bullet struck him. Gideon didn't know whose. The warrior dropped his rifle and threw his arms around his horse's neck, trying to hold on. He did not lose his shield. It was looped to his arm. The third rider jerked the trigger as he passed Gideon. Gideon was sure he felt the heat of the blast, though the bullet missed. The Indian thrust the smoking muzzle forward and tried to touch Gideon to count coup. In that also, he was unsuccessful. The wounded Indian rode a little farther, lost his hold, and fell heavily to the ground. He pushed to his knees, badly stunned. To Gideon's amazement, the other two turned back. He thought they were going to charge at him and Jimbo again. Instead, they leaned from their running horses and grabbed up the fallen warrior between them. They were coming straight at Gideon, but he could only stare in wonder at what they had done. They swung around and galloped away, carrying the third man by the arms. Several more soldiers were on the hilltop now, joining Hollander and Maloney in their firing. But they seemed to have no luck at hitting such a rapidly moving target.
Come back, Indians!
Gideon's heart pumped hot and fast. It suddenly occurred to him that his fear had vanished. He felt a wild, almost drunken exhilaration. He was enjoying this moment in a way he had never enjoyed anything before.
Come back!
Instead, they set the third man down, and one caught the runaway horse. When the wounded warrior was back on his mount, the one with the lightning streak shield waved something over his head. By the time the last of the soldiers reached the hilltop, the Indians were gone, descending at another point 300 yards away. Unaccountably, Gideon was laughing. His heart felt swollen and his whole body tingled.
We stood him off, Jimbo. Me and you. We stood him off.
He saw the rifle the wounded Indian had dropped. On impulse, he spurred the brown horse to get there and retrieve the firearm before someone else.
Get! There's liable to be more of them!
There weren't.
Woo-hoo!
Gideon returned with the rifle, his blood still racing. Jimbo stared at him as if convinced he'd gone crazy. Gideon wondered too, for never had he felt a lightheadedness quite like this. Jimbo wasn't laughing. He knelt and ran his hand along the shoulder of his fallen horse, down to where the arrow shaft bobbed in the last gasping breaths of the animal's life.
Careful he don't take a spasm and kick you.
Jimbo's eyes were soft with pity.
He's past kicking. Past anything. He was a pretty good horse.
To Jimbo, they were all good. He had even had kind words for Gideon's Judas. Now that Gideon thought about it, he realized the brown hadn't threatened to run this time. Jimbo laid his hand on the neck of Gideon's brown horse, just forward of the heavily laden McClellan saddle.
If you hadn't come back for me, Gid, they'd have butchered me like a hog.
Gideon said nothing. His action had been instinctive, just as when the York girl's skirt caught a fire. He didn't feel right in taking credit. He had a guilty suspicion that if he had time to consider, he might have kept going.
You come after me that other time.
Jimbo was sobered by the loss of his horse and by what could easily have happened to himself.
Well, I reckon we're both kind of dumb.
He could not control himself. It was a release from tension, and it was infectious. The other soldiers, holding their carbines, had formed a semicircle. They stared in silent suspicion that the pair had lost their minds. Lieutenant Hollander studied them with apprehension, then relief.
Charger, Jimbo, I take it that neither you suffered a wound.
They never touched us.
Maloney leaned forward in his saddle.
Now don't you boys let it go to your heads. Far as I could see, you didn't touch them either.
Gideon had not given the tracker much thought during those anxious moments. Now it came back to him that Maloney had stayed at the rim of the hill. He cast aside the caution old Colonel had warned him to keep.
You didn't come out and help us none.
Maloney could have taken violent offense.
You boys made one mistake riding out there by yourselves. I'd have made another if I'd gone after you. Anyway, I did more good where I was at. I shot the one that fell off his horse.
Gideon reluctantly decided to give Maloney the benefit of the doubt, and as he thought back, he realized how much room for doubt there truly was. Hollander smiled.
I knew it from the first, Charger. You have it in you to be a first-rate soldier.
Troopers who had been resentful of Gideon before began congratulating him for staying by Jimbo. It was a good feeling while it lasted. But when the congratulations were through, Gideon and Jimbo still had to face Sergeant Nettles. With him, kind words were as rare as July snow.
If you all had had the sense God gave a jackrabbit, you'd have stayed at the edge of the hill till the others got there. Now you've lost a horse. You can't break the other one down by riding him double. You gotta take turns. One riding, then one walking.
After the elation, it was as if Nettles had poured cold water on Gideon's bare back. Maloney took a battered, partially smoked cigar he'd been saving from his shirt pocket, then scratched a match on his belt buckle.
Maloney, we best be moving. We still got two men back there somewhere.
Had, Frank. Had.
He jerked his chin at Gideon.
Let's see that rifle you picked up.
Gideon held it out. The lieutenant took it.
Spencer carbine. Army issue.
Maloney nodded grimly.
And still in army hands up to an hour or so ago, I'd wager. Did you see what that Indian waved at us just before they skinned out?
Hollander's face showed he was beginning to suspect.
At that distance...
Scalps, Frank. Two fresh, woolly scalps.
Gideon's skin prickled and went cold. He saw horror strike Hollander, then turned quickly to anger.
Damn fools! I told them! Sergeant Nettles, a column of twos.
Finding the men was easy. Leatherman and Ripley had gone less than a mile from the edge of the hill. Leatherman seemed to be kneeling, his forehead touching the ground. Ripley lay on his back, his sightless eyes open. He had died staring into the sun. Each man had three arrows driven deeply into his body. The two horses were dead.
When the Indians found the horses lame, they killed them. They made sure the army would never use them again.
Gideon did not want to look, but he couldn't pull his eyes away. His stomach turned over. He feared he might disgrace himself by throwing up. Two other recruits did. Gideon had seen dead people before, but most had died of natural causes. The worst sight he had ever seen was a slave on old Colonel's plantation many years ago, who had sought a place to hide while he drank a bottle of bad whiskey. He had made the mistake of getting himself trapped in a high box stall by a mean mule, which had kicked and stomped him into a sodden mass his own mother couldn't have identified. Old Colonel, though he liked a nip himself, forced his slaves to view the remains as an object lesson on the evils of drink. Hollander made similar use of the two hapless soldiers.
Sergeant Nettles, I want all the men to come by in single file. I want every soldier to take a good look. I want all of you to remember what you see here. I want you to know what can happen when you abuse your horses, when you disobey orders, when you go off by yourselves. Out here, every man depends on every other. Any man who gets careless, who shirks his duty, is a danger to everybody around him. So look! God damn it, even if it makes you sick to your stomach. Look and remember.
Gideon would remember. If he lived to be 106, he would never forget. He would always wish he could. But he knew he would remember something else. That unaccountable soaring of spirit when he had faced his enemies and stood his ground as their equal. He would always respect this country and its dangers, but he would never be afraid of it again. He had stood up to its challenge, and he had prevailed. He looked far ahead toward the thin line of trees that marked the beginnings of the North Concho River. Suddenly, nothing about it seemed strange any longer. To the Comanche, a name was not a permanent and sacred thing to be fastened upon an infant and worn unchanged throughout life. An old name could be abandoned, a new one adopted. Many a young warrior insisted upon it, shedding a nondescript name from his childhood and assuming a new one befitting his status as an adult, skilled on the hunt and in war. Thus had Cub with a Bad Foot become Bear That Turns to Fight, as soon as he had returned from his first horse-gathering trip down into the settlements of the Tejanos. That name was of his own selection. To those young men of his own age group who knew him best, he was known with a faint derision as Bear That Growls All the Time. Inasmuch as the use of this name tended to make him want to fight, and using the name of his own preference did not suit the others, he was most often simply called Bear, a compromise that left everything understood and nothing settled. Consequently, Bear was usually growling about something. He had been particularly embittered about Gray Horse Running and his cousin Limping Boy. Set off to scout, they had come upon and taken a small horse herd without first returning to the rest of the party to give everyone else a chance to share honor. The other young men had been pleased enough simply to get the extra horses, since the results of their own efforts to that point had been meager. But Bear had made an issue of it, and did not drop the argument until the party's leader, Eagle Feather, told him to quiet down or go off by himself. Gray Horse considered that his medicine had shown him the way to the horses. Sent to scout west of the main party, Gray Horse and Limping Boy had come upon a wolf, a big male, a worthy specimen of his race. Gray Horse was certain the amber eyes had gazed directly into his. Then the wolf had changed directions and trotted to the northwest. Most Comanches would have regarded this as a bad omen and changed their own direction, but Gray Horse had the wolf medicine. He took it as a sign that he was meant to follow. Presently, the wolf led them to a trail left by driven horses, a trail so fresh the droppings were warm. Shortly, Gray Horse and Limping Boy hauled up behind some 20 horses being driven by a lone man, a Mexican, judging by his dark skin and broad straw hat. He was singing a song that had an alien and almost painful sound to Gray Horse's ears. His mind seemed to be on things other than danger. Limping Boy fitted an arrow to his bow.
There's greater honor in defeating your enemy in personal combat than in an ambush.
With his war club, Gray Horse had taken the first coup against the buffalo soldier on the Colorado River. With the same war club, he would count coup again and throw the matter into the face of Bear, who liked to kill, but always at a distance. Drumming his heels against the ribs of his pony, Gray Horse took a firm grip on the club. The startled Mexican had a rifle in a scabbard beneath his leg. He reached down and pulled it out too late. The stone club sent his straw hat sailing as the Mexican fell. The action boogered the horse herd into a hard run. Gray Horse had it in mind to finish the Mexican and take his scalp, but this might cost him the horses. He chose to retain the greater prize. The rest of his life, the vaquero would have a story to tell and a scar to prove it by. Limping Boy was beside himself with pride in his cousin's feat and in his own good fortune at sharing it. They were a year apart in age. As far back as Gray Horse could remember, Limping Boy had followed him like a pup, always a step behind in his training, but always grateful to learn. Limping Boy, then only 5 or 6, had gained his name and a stiffened leg in an attack upon the family's buffalo hunting camp by Texas Rangers in a reprisal foray. If he had let it, the handicap could have turned him into a saddle maker or other useful craftsman like most of the Mexican boy captives. But he had grown up following Gray Horse, determined to become a warrior in the best tradition. Slow and awkward afoot, he was as good on horseback as any youth of similar age in the band. The wound to his leg had done no damage to his heart. Bear continued to badger Limping Boy as they brought up the rear together, driving the horses. He reminded Limping Boy of his seniority, of the fact that his father had often brought meat to the teepee of Limping Boy's widowed mother. In exasperation, Limping Boy gave him the rifle he had retrieved from the fallen Mexican, together with the scabbard and ammunition taken from the Mexican's horse. However, Limping Boy failed to tell him the barrel was full of dirt. When Bear fired at a rabbit, the barrel split, blackening and burning Bear's face. Perhaps indulging a warped sense of humor, Eagle Feather dispatched Gray Horse, Limping Boy, and Bear as a rear guard, dropping way behind to watch for sign of pursuit and to do what was necessary to slow it. Ahead lay the open plains. Rarely did the white or buffalo soldiers pursue them far onto that great ocean of grass. From a stand of junipers, the three watched the cavalry patrol make its way carefully down the steep and rocky hill where the raiding party had come with the captured horses earlier. They watched, puzzled, as two troopers took a shortcut and let their horses fall. They watched later as these same two troopers led their horses back up the hill while the rest of the detail went on. The three warriors held the nostrils of their horses while the main body of soldiers passed, following the trail. Gray Horse noted that a Tejano seemed to lead them, two black soldiers flanking him as his guard. Bear gave vent to an ancient Comanche hatred.
I would like to have that Tejano's scalp hanging in my lodge.
It is yours. All you have to do is kill all those soldiers first.
They are buffalo soldiers, not even white. The only white faces I see are the Tejano and one other. He is a chief, more than likely.
Gray Horse had heard it said that the black soldiers were slaves of some kind, perhaps like the Mexican youths or the occasional young Utes or Apaches the people captured and allowed to live as menials. But he had also heard it said they could be bitter fighters. He remembered that the one he had struck with his club on the Colorado had been coming to meet him, not running away. It was not the Comanche custom to attack a greatly superior force, but Gray Horse let Bear believe he contemplated it.
If you think so little of the black soldiers, you take all of them, and Limping Boy and I will take the two with the white faces.
We will take the two buffalo soldiers who turned back. That will be honor enough for one day.
They waited until the main body of soldiers were far away before venturing out of the junipers. Bear used the time to paint his face for war, streaking black paint along one side and yellow on the other. Gray Horse and Limping Boy followed his example. Gray Horse painted the lightning on his face and the lightning and wolf tracks on his body that he carried on his shield. Bear took the lead in climbing the hill. Far ahead, they saw the two lonely soldiers still walking and leading their horses. The whole thing was so pathetically easy that Gray Horse took little pride in it afterward, though Bear would always make it seem a great encounter in the telling. They came up behind the soldiers undetected until one of the limping horses looked back, pointing its ears. By then, the warriors were too near for their arrows to miss.
My God!
One of the black soldiers raised his rifle in self-defense, and Gray Horse put an arrow into him. The other soldier dropped his rifle, fell on his knees, and began to sob.
Lord Jesus, don't kill me!
Gray Horse judged that he was pleading for his life, though the words had no more meaning to him than the barking of a camp dog. Bear shot this one through the heart, his arrow turning slightly upward as it struck the breastbone. Each warrior put an arrow into each soldier, so they shared equally in the kill. But Bear claimed both scalps, inasmuch as he was in charge. The killing was cold and mechanical, done without passion or pity, for the Comanche was taught from childhood to despise his enemies, to know that all but the people themselves were something less than true human beings. White people, and these blacks were only white people with a different look, were fair game wherever found, like the antelope or the buffalo. Gray Horse watched dispassionately as Bear worried with the short, kinky black hair, trying to peel enough for a proper display. He cursed the soldiers for cheating him and marked them with his knife to show his displeasure. Curious, Limping Boy tore open the shirt of the soldier who lay on his back, eyes glazing. He rubbed his hand against the skin and looked at his fingers.
I have heard they are white people painted black, but the paint does not come off.
Their blood is red.
They are Tabos, just like all the others. They have lived in the sun more. The black skin does not make them different inside.
He touched his chest where the heart was. Bear took the shiniest rifle and reluctantly gave the other to Limping Boy. He glanced at Gray Horse to be sure his cousin realized he was purposely left out. He gathered the ammunition belts and canteens, which would be useful. He finally chose to give Gray Horse a pistol taken from one of the soldiers, not feeling it necessary to point out that it was a lesser item than a rifle. He puzzled over the heavy steel picket pins hanging in a ring on each saddle. They were too short to use as a club and much too large for an awl. Gray Horse suspected their true purpose and suggested that he and Limping Boy might find some use for them. Because both horses limped badly, they would be more liability than asset. Bear was about to try his new rifle when Gray Horse suggested the shot might be heard by the other soldiers. They used arrows instead, afterward digging them out with their knives for use another time. Good arrows were not to be wasted. Those in the soldiers' bodies were left alone. An arrow which had killed a man was never used again. The incident had taken a lot of time. Gray Horse worried aloud that the main body of soldiers might overtake or at least harry Eagle Feather and the others. Bear finally agreed, though he took time to mutilate the soldiers a bit more, to cause them embarrassment and impotence in the afterlife, if the scalping did not rob them of it entirely. With the caution drilled into them from boyhood, the three dismounted and looked over the edge of the hill without skylining themselves for anyone below to see. It was a fortunate precaution. The soldiers were returning, giving up the trail of the stolen horses. They were climbing this hill in single file. Gray Horse and Bear looked at each other, and for once they found nothing to argue about.
Perhaps the Tejano will come first.
Whoever comes first, we will get him.
If they were lucky, they might get two or three before so many soldiers reached the top that they had to leave. If the spirits were pleased, they might even take two or three more horses with them. Gray Horse hunched at the rim, watching to see the order in which the men were making the climb. He pulled back from the edge before straightening and running for his mount.
Two of the buffalo soldiers are ahead of the Tejano. If we wait until all three are on top, we can kill them and be gone before the others can do anything.
The Tejano is mine.
Gray Horse saw that Bear intended to use his newly acquired rifle.
Do you really know enough about it yet?
If it will work for a soldier, it will work for me.
Gray Horse saw that Limping Boy intended to use his, too. He was almost glad he had not been given a rifle. He knew the bow, the arrow. He expected that the first soldiers to reach the top would stay at the edge until they were reinforced. That would have been the prudent thing. It would also have bunched them better for attack. To his surprise, the first black soldier kept riding, the second following and calling. The tension was too much for Bear. Before the Tejano had properly reached the top, Bear charged from behind the stunted cedar. Almost at once, the Tejano and both soldiers were firing. Gray Horse loosed an arrow that found a soldier's horse and brought it down. The other soldier instantly went to the downed one's rescue, as a Comanche would. The one on the ground fell to one knee, bringing his rifle into use. Gray Horse seemed to be looking straight down a gun barrel at the desperate wide eyes and black face behind it. He swung his bullhide shield around, its feathers and buffalo tail flaring. A bullet struck with the force of a heavy war club. It almost ripped the shield from his arm, tearing off one or more of the feathers. But the convex shape, hard as flint, sent the slug whining away. From the rim, the Tejano was firing with calm and deliberation. The ferocity of the resistance startled Gray Horse. He saw Bear slump forward and drop his rifle. Limping Boy got off one shot, which struck nothing, then jammed the unfamiliar weapon. He tried in vain to touch the soldier. There was no more time for arrows. Bear slipped from his horse and hit the ground. Gray Horse and Limping Boy turned back, their eyes meeting in agreement. Bear was rising to his knees, stunned. From boyhood, Gray Horse and Limping Boy had trained for this emergency. To leave a fellow warrior wounded or dead on the battleground at the mercy of enemies was cowardice of the worst kind, as unforgivable as the murder of another Comanche. Leaning down, passing on opposite sides, they caught Bear under his arms and lifted him up between them. The rescue run carried them toward the soldiers, and bullets passed them like angry hornets, but neither man questioned the need. They turned, Gray Horse taking the outside of the pivot. At a fair distance, they pulled up and eased Bear to the ground. Limping Boy loped on to catch Bear's loose horse. Gray Horse saw that Bear's wound was high in his shoulder, far from the heart. He would always have the scar to brag about. Because this was Bear, Gray Horse knew he would. Limping Boy brought Bear's horse, and they held Bear onto him. Gray Horse's blood ran hot. He was reluctant to turn away from the fight. He jerked loose the two scalps Bear had tied to his rawhide bridle, and he waved them over his head with a loud shout of defiance. Then he led Bear and Limping Boy down the rough hillside, leaving the soldiers far behind.